There is no remembrance of times gone and past, nor shall there be any remembrance to last of those coming later, yet who have not been. By those coming after shall they not be seen. That was Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 11. Our daily scripture for today, little children, from the Ward Green Version 2004. And we're just about to conclude our study of the article Trojan War with the summary here. Chapter 12, the last paragraph, which is chapter 12, paragraph 12. Dendrochronology, or the study of annual tree rings to date events, is used to calibrate radiocarbon numbers. As we gather in paragraph 2, there are no trees that may be known today that are any older than the deluge. So in other words, the deluge wiped out all living, breathing things on the surface of the earth. Not necessarily did it wipe out the sea creatures, of course, but it wiped out trees as well as plants, all the plants and all the breathing animals on the surface, the face of the earth. And so the age of the oldest trees that we find today is proof of the deluge. The date of the deluge has been shown, therefore, to be no older than the date which we, in fact, also find in the genealogy, which is 3282 BCE. A really outstanding proof of the chronology of the genealogy. And in the footnote there, we see that it's mentioned with regard to the river deltas. People have studied the depth of the sediments at the mouth of the rivers, and if the river had been flowing for a certain number of years, of course, the sediments would have achieved a certain thickness based on how long the river had been flowing. And they, it turns out, prove also that these rivers that are flowing today have not been flowing from a time period earlier than 3282 BCE. It's just amazing. They're not going to be able to date the time of the beginning of the flow of the rivers completely accurately, but it's quite clear that our chronology is consistent with that as well, that with the flowing of the rivers. And if you look at some of the videos produced by Creation Ministries International on YouTube, for example, you'll see there that there's one gentleman who has been a part of making those videos, who was a scholar who studied, and he was agnostic, but he studied, without believing in God initially, all the flood plain information of floods all over the world. He was an expert on flooding, and he studied fluvial, or deposits caused by the fluvial activities or floods, and erosion caused by floods, all those things that he was expert in, led him to independently arrive at the conclusion that there must have been a global flood, because he found that as much as 40% of continents, and more in some cases, are composed of these flat plateaus, which are very high compared to the lowest valleys, which have been somehow eroded out of these plateaus in such a way that the valleys are enormous and really, really don't fit the theory of rivers flowing through these regions, these continental regions, and eroding away. Obviously rivers do erode away material, but the size of the rivers that are flowing today is nothing in comparison to the amount of erosion that's seen. And so there's a phenomenon called underfit rivers, where the river that's flowing there today could never produce the size of valley that is present. Whereas it can be explained by a global deluge. So this gentleman arrived at the conclusion, this one particular gentleman, that there was a global deluge, and that was when he was agnostic. Before he became a believer, then even though he was initially agnostic, he came to believe there must be a God. And perhaps that was because of the fact that there was an account of the deluge in the Bible. I'm not sure what the reason was, but he started talking about there having been a global deluge, and that God must exist because of this. And so one of his colleagues at the university where he was working, you know, challenged him to say there was no God, and, you know, asked that he go with her to the church, his own church, but he didn't have a church, so he just took her to a church, and she was contending that she could prove that there was no God if they would go to a church. But they went to a church which happened to have, at least as the story goes, a large amount of Holy Spirit at this church. And so after they went to this church, they both became believers in Jesus Christ on the same day that they went to the church. So, and then he married her after that. But the idea that, you know, that all the features on earth today can be explained by the deluge and by the Bible is quite compelling, even for scientists who are initially not believers. And all his colleagues, by the way, all of his colleagues, he said, all of his close colleagues, you know, came to agree with him that there must have been a global deluge. And yet, you know, because that was what the evidence said, or it agreed with the evidence, but they weren't willing to, you know, make this publicly known, because they realized it would affect their career, you know. So the thing is, the world is not in favor of the Bible. The world in general is not in favor of the Bible. So scientists cannot just come right out and say, I believe in a global deluge, you know. They can't say that, because it's going to be a lot of persecution for them by their other colleagues. From their other colleagues, they will be persecuted by their institutions and the colleagues of those institutions. So, and yet we find incredible proof. Now, there was a story from the question that people ask. Well, okay, so let's say, you know, if you believe the Bible, then where did the dinosaurs, you know, come from? If they're from an early date, then were they on the ark, and did Noah bring the dinosaurs with him on the ark? And there are certainly, I've noticed that many people have said yes, or some people who believe the Bible say yes, of course, dinosaurs were on the ark. But the question then becomes, well, how could you possibly bring a Tyrannosaurus Rex on Noah's Ark? And it at first seems impossible, but then the answer is, of course, you can't, except you can bring these babies, baby dinosaurs, when they're very young, you can bring them on the ark before they've grown to full size. So that was the explanation of how the dinosaurs could have been on the ark. And then, of course, they died off after the ice age, which succeeded after the deluge, because of the difference in the continental temperatures, that was greatly more extreme after the deluge, whereas prior to the deluge there had been a lot of water. There's a theory about the water canopy, you know, that it equalized the temperature over the surface of the earth. After the deluge, when the water came down, the more extreme temperatures of winter became more prevalent on the continents, and this was, in fact, also aggravated by the fact that the waters that came down were not particularly cold, and they were, in fact, warm. So the oceans became very warm, and that caused a lot of evaporation, which led to a lot of snowfall on the continents. And it was not warm enough, to melt all the snow, so that there was an ice age that occurred partially. And of course, there could never be a full ice age, as explained by the fact that if there were a full ice age, if ice had ever come across the whole globe, all life would have died on the surface again of the earth. So the ice age after the deluge is consistent with a global deluge, or at least it can be seen to be completely consistent. It just depends on whether you're open to the idea of the deluge and the fact that the oceans could have been warm after the deluge, which would cause a lot more evaporation. Even if you raise the temperature of the ocean by 1 degree, there's a lot more evaporation. So if it were several degrees warmer, it would have caused an enormous amount of rain, and or at least snow in the winter time, for example. I'm trying to imagine whether it causes more rain, but I guess it would cause more rain too. I'm not sure why the rain wouldn't wash away the snow in the summertime. I'm trying to think if there's another mitigating factor. But the coastal regions would have been warm if the oceans were warm, and that's where the dinosaurs would have lived. But as the oceans cooled off, the dinosaurs must have died. Now, did the dinosaurs live inland, though? I think they possibly did. I'm not sure. As well. But the evidence of the fossils also speaks of the deluge, of it being a global deluge, because, you know, you can't get fossils without large amounts of sediment, and all the runoff from the global deluge would have completely explained all of these huge valleys like the Grand Canyon and all these places around the world where the continents and the continental shelves, the plateaus, that is, of the continents have been greatly gouged, and huge rocks have been left behind in places where you wouldn't find that, but can easily be explained by a deluge having carried these rocks and deposited them as it drained off. All the fossils can be explained by this massive amount of sediment that was deposited through this huge erosion that occurred when the waters flowed off as well. Now, we don't understand enough about global dynamics in temperatures, so even today when they do models and they model the temperatures For example, with global warming, the models they use are extremely inaccurate, and they're making a huge number of assumptions and guesses about how things work because we don't understand a system so complex as the Earth. So, you know, the Earth's dynamical atmosphere and the way it interacts with the magnetic field and the cosmic rays and all these things to do with, for example, the carbon 14 is involved with that process of the cosmic rays, but also to do with just the temperature of the Earth. That is very poorly understood according to the models that humans have. We don't understand it well enough. So to try and model it and try and understand how an ice age could occur, of course, is very difficult. It's virtually impossible using human models. So that's why a documentary record is more valid, more significant. You know, the fact that the Bible tells us it happened, that's more important than any model we could come up with scientifically. Although we can see the erosion, we can see the river deltas, how thick they are, we can see how old the trees are, we can see all these things that tell us that even though nothing proves anything absolutely, we can see that all the evidence is in fact consistent with the idea of a global deluge. And so we come to the end of our article. Trojan War Year-End Report, Quilt Work Patch. The article by yours truly from 2015, late in that year. And what we're going to do next, I'm not sure, but for, you know, maybe we'll study another article after a rest from these articles. Or maybe we'll continue right on. But for today, though, I want to study something else. I want to talk about audio and some of the problems with audio. Like audio impedance is something that I want to explain. Like when you have a very quiet mic and you can't, you know, your audio output isn't high enough that people can hear you talking on your mic. That could be caused by many different things, actually. But one thing, the obvious thing, is that the input level of the microphone might be too low. So no matter whether you're on a Mac or in Windows, you go into the audio settings and you look at the microphone input volume. It's not the output level, but the input. So you select the input, you go to look at the input levels, and there's a line input level and a mic input level, usually. And the mic input level might be too low, and that might be possible to adjust it. For example, if you're running this program here, OBS, if you're doing a broadcast or something, or making a video using OBS, you see the mic level is shown over here at the bottom. This is the mic level, which is currently set here by this slider at about minus 40 because I'm using a Phantom powered studio mic, and I've even set the mic level quite low here, minus 40, and I'm still getting adequate signal as you can see here, but the setting level is actually indicated there is actually minus 19 for the slider level, but you can see right here the minus 19 is probably right somewhere. Obviously, it's right up here. It's right in this region. It just means that I'm not going to be exceeding the saturation level or the peak level of the computer. In digital systems, you always get clipping if you go too high in the voltage. So if this level is set too high, you're going to get clipping, which is going to sound terrible, and it can even, I think, very possibly cause some discomfort and maybe even ear damage. But you don't want to, it just sounds terrible, basically. But it possibly could hurt your ears, or the ears of your listeners, so you don't want to be too high with this level either. But you don't want to be too low, where you can't hear anything at the output. This looks like a medium amount of signal. You can see it's coming up to the middle or a little higher on the scale when I talk. And this is in the program OBS. What does OBS stand for? Broadcast studio or something. Something broadcast studio. Software. Broadcast. Let's see. Software. It's something to do with broadcast software. I'm not doing a live stream. I'm just doing a recording. But I'm using OBS to do that. And you can set up, you know, as I've done, you go to your settings and you can change your different settings, which I'm not going to do right now. I'm not going to show you that. But the thing is, there's almost always a place where you go, like on your computer, like this. You got your output, your input. Your input, currently I'm set for external mic. And then you see the, where's the level? Right here. You see the input volume is right here. And the input volume is quite low here on my input for the computer, set quite low here. But the level I'm getting that's coming in, you can see that as well. It's coming in about to 2/3 of the way at the most up on the scale here when it indicates that I'm as I'm talking, right? So those are the sound input levels that can be adjusted, right? The other thing I want to talk about is impedance. So the idea of impedance, let's see what we can do if I can go back here. When you've got a microphone, it's got a certain impedance, okay? Like a resistance through which the current flows, and that produces a voltage. Now, when you have a very low impedance microphone, that's good because it means that if the impedance of the microphone were higher than the impedance of the input of the system of the computer, so the resistance, that is, if it were higher in the microphone than it is in the system, you would end up with more of the voltage produced by the microphone would be in the microphone itself because it's higher impedance. Like, let's see, if you just have a current flowing, a current is always going to be, like, we're just assuming a constant current flowing, like caused by a constant tone, like if you were to speak with a droning sound, it would cause a current. That current would be flowing in the resistance of the mic, and it would then flow through the resistance of the input. If the input impedance of the system is lower than the impedance of the mic, then more of the voltage will actually occur in the microphone and less of it in the system. That's not what you want. You want a low impedance in the microphone and a high impedance in the system so that more of the voltage appears by the same current flowing through a bigger resistance in the computer, because current times resistance equals voltage, so you'll have more voltage, which will be a louder volume in the computer if your mic input is lower. So high impedance mics might not be the way to go if you've got a very low impedance input in your computer, right? Normally, I looked it up, sound cards have quite a low impedance compared to some of the traditional audio equipment of yesteryears. Usually they would have a pretty high input impedance, especially for a high impedance mic. Now, a high impedance mic used to be just a non-studio quality, more of a, I'm not sure if it's simply a a public address system mic, or just not a professional mic. Whereas, you know, so they would be higher impedance, and that means they require a very high input impedance, which is found in the less professional audio equipment. So the impedance, that's called impedance matching, even though it's not matched exactly. But if they're equal, that would work okay. You'd only be half and half the signal in the mic. Half the voltage would appear across the mic, and you can't hear that. But the voltage that appears in the amplifier, that you can hear. So half and half is okay, but you don't want to have all the signal in the mic and very little in the amplifier. You can't hear it very well. It's going to be lower in volume. So that's why, you know, lower impedance mics are good for systems that have low input impedance, such as computers, for example. But I don't think that's the only cause of the issue, though. Now, there are phantom mics, apparently Electret mics. I looked that up because I wasn't sure what voltage they produce, but the input on a computer generally is like a line level input. It's not designed for very, you know, low impedance mics or anything like that. It's not really set up for that, and that's why I have a preamp on my mic. So if you can get a preamp for your very expensive mic, you can boost the signal to a line level. That's what you really want for going into a computer. But you want to get a good quality preamp, you know, one that is a high fidelity, you know, a good quality preamp. I'm using my Behringer ADA-8200, I think it's called. It's a very versatile machine, but I'm just using it as a preamp. It's a piece of equipment. I shouldn't call it a machine, I guess. It doesn't have any moving parts. Well, it has the knobs for the adjustments of the volume and so on. But I can set my preamp level of the mic, and it has to be set very precisely for it to work optimally. So if you get a preamp, you're going to spend some time tuning that setting. But if you... Okay. So my mic, you know, is also a phantom-powered mic, which many studio mics are. Not all of them. I also have a mic that's a dynamic mic that was the Beyer M88, a very famous mic that was used by the Queen of England and by Phil Collins and people like that. I have that mic. But I've got my Beyer MC740N, which is a 5-pattern. I guess you call it a condenser mic because it's an Electret, or it's a condenser mic that requires phantom power, which all Electret condenser mics do. Even the small little Electret, I think, well, maybe they don't. Maybe they have their own built-in power. I'm not sure about the computer. Like, for example, when you have a set of ear pods, like I have here, these ear pods that Apple make. Apple makes these ear pods. They have built-in mics. Now, there's no battery in these, so they're not getting any phantom power unless it's from the computer itself. So these are just... I'm not sure what the technology is. If they're Electrets, Electrets, as far as I was always aware, require some kind of phantom power, which means you get some power from the input device that comes back to the mic before it can produce a signal. But that can't be true of these, because, well, yeah, that can be true. They could be, but there's no battery in them, whereas Electrets also could have had their own battery too in years past. And you would have to replace that battery in some cases, but there are. I mean, I haven't. It's such a huge. Nobody understands input impedance, but I do. But that's one thing you have to be aware of when you're trying to match your levels, and also the input level that's set on your computer. If it's too high, it can clip the signal, which is terrible. You wouldn't have had that problem years ago on analog equipment, but it's a problem with all computer devices of this clipping level. You can't exceed a certain level, and you have to be safely below that level to prevent clipping. So, wait, let's go back some more, see what else I looked up here. Yeah, professional mics have between 150 and 600 ohms of impedance, right? 200 ohms is typical for a professional mic, such as the ones that I use in the studio and right here now. But sound cards have an input impedance of 600 to 2,000. So if your sound card impedance is, it's generally not a problem, but if your sound card were 600, let's say, and your microphone were 10,000 ohms, because it was a high impedance mic, which would not generally be a professional mic at all, but if that were true, you'd just have to look up the specs of your mic. If that were true, you'd have an impedance mismatch, because you would have too much of the signal being wasted in the microphone, and not enough of it would actually be entering the amplifier, right? Because the current flowing produces a voltage, and the voltage would be divided across the two devices. If your input impedance is too low compared to the mic being high, you're just not going to get any voltage inside the computer, because even though there's a significant current now, of course, with a high impedance mic, maybe the current's going to be lower too, because to produce the same voltage with a high impedance requires less current, so you're not going to get much current to start with, and then you're going to get less of the voltage total in the device, because most of it will be wasted in the mic, which is why you want a low mic impedance relative to a high device input impedance for the computer. In this case, in most cases, impedance is not a problem, it says. Yeah, it's just something to be aware of. It could be a problem in some cases. What's the impedance of a mic level input? See, there are high impedance mic inputs, 20,000 plus ohms. Looking back to the microphone, it says here, well, there can be, so this is just talking about the mic impedance, which could be 50 to 1,000 ohms. That would be low impedance, like we were talking there, 150 to 600 or 50 to 1,000. Those are low impedance mics. Medium impedance mics can be 5,000 to 15,000 ohms resistance and or impedance, and high impedance mics, 20,000 plus. Most Audio Technica, they're just talking about that, but it's any professional mic is going to be low impedance. That's just something to keep in mind or be aware of. And then you want so that's usually going to be not a problem with a computer, because even though the computer has a fairly low input impedance, because it's expecting also, it's expecting a very high level signal too. Right, so it doesn't have to have it doesn't have a preamp, first of all. It's expecting a line level signal, which is sort of 1 volt or 0.3 for consumer equipment, whereas a mic produces a lot less than that without a preamp, so you might want a preamp. So anyway, that's a standard PC mic has a small amplifier transistor built into the electret, and it requires 5 volts . So there you go. See? So where does it get the 5 volts? I think it gets it from the computer, maybe, because they don't have batteries in them anymore like they used to. Anyway, that's it for today's study. It is August 31st, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 1931 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. Thank you for listening and watching. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty. This is Cassie. And they're saying bye for now. And that concludes our study of the article, Trojan War. And so that was the end of chapter 12, paragraph 12.